So today's Teisho will be on case 46 in the book of equanimity, the book of equanimity or the book of serenity. Case 46 is entitled Deshan's Completion of Study. Introduction. The clear ground, where there's not an inch of grass for 10,000 miles, deludes people. The clear sky without a fleck of cloud in the eight directions fools you. Even though this is using a wedge to remove a wedge, it doesn't prevent taking space and hanging it in space. A single mallet on the back of the brain, particularly observe appropriate technique. Okay. Case. The great master Yuan Ming of Deshan said to the assembly, "When you get to the ultimate end, you just find the Buddhas of all times have their mouths hung on the wall." There is still someone who laughs. "Ha ha, if you know this one, your task of study is finished." Get verse, gathering in, holding closed the throat. Wind polishes, clouds wipe. The waters are chill, the weather is autumn. Don't say brocade-colored fish lack rich taste. Fishing through the ocean waves, one hook of moon. Today is day 5 of our wonderful winter sesshin 2011. Everybody has been doing a really wonderful job. Some people are here for the first time, and it's really quite impressive. I'm just really amazed at some people who are first timers sitting so well. There was one young lady who came and left the next day because this was just hugely overwhelming for her. And she's a very nice person. She came to see me after breakfast. Or was it after lunch? I think it might have been after lunch. She came to see me and said, "Can I talk to you for a minute?" She looked very worried. And then I said, "Sure, let me just finish this." And then I came out into the Zendo. And Dimitri was in here, and I asked him if I could have the Zendo to myself for a moment. And the young lady came in and sat down, and she said, "Listen, I don't think I really want to achieve enlightenment after all." Really, that's what she said. She said, "You know, I started sitting in September, and now I'm not so sure I want enlightenment." I thought that was so cute. And then she said, "My mind is just like, I feel like I'm going insane, right?" And I said, "Oh, you know, this is a lot of sitting, you know." I said, "Are you a Rutgers student?" And she said, "Yes." And then I said, "What are you studying?" And she said, "I'm not sure." And I said, "Well, what year are you?" And she said, "I'm not sure." And I realized she doesn't want me to know anything about her. You know, I think maybe she was afraid I was going to track her down or something. You know? Nobody leaves Sashin. Once you're hooked, you know, you'll never get free. I really think she was afraid. And I just said, "Look, you know, this is like, you know," I said, "you've been practicing, you sit once a week or something." And I said, "That's like running a mile every week and then entering the New York Marathon." I said, "You know, this is the marathon." So I actually, said, please try to not let this lead you to a negative impression of meditation. You know, you might get home and decide that this is still quite valuable. So please, give it a try again. And if you want to do it more seriously, the way we do it, come to a Saturday, sit, build up your concentration. And I think she left, you know, with many strange and new emotions and so on. But you know, she had a little glimpse of something that was different, right? And I had an interesting dream last night. I've been very sick, you know, so I've had, you know, sometimes you might have noticed at Sesshin you have strange dreams, you know. But when I'm sick, I have strange dreams. And I had a dream last night where I noticed people were going into an elevator shaft. There was no elevator. They were just going into the shaft and disappearing. And they were calmly walking in and disappearing. And, you know, somebody said to me, don't worry, you know, you'll go down very gently, you know. And I looked down into the shaft and I thought, I don't think I'm going to try this, you know. And then I woke up, you know. So maybe it was like that for this young woman, you know. She was afraid she was going to drop down an elevator shaft or something. Many of you are here for the first time and just doing an amazing job. And that's really wonderful. I have been doing this for 34 years, something like that, and I love it, absolutely love it. And it's not everybody's cup of tea. Some people do it for a while and decide they want to do something else. Some people do it all their lives, you know, but I think it's meaningful and very important for people. This is really like, I think, no other experience that life offers people. It's really quite extraordinary. It's a process of understanding the world better, but also understanding ourselves much better, understanding our minds better, much better. And this is understanding the self at a depth and in a detail, I think, that's really unmatched. You know? There's just nothing like it that I've ever encountered. It's really extraordinary. You know, we have a lot of anybody who starts doing Zen, starts doing meditation, has high ideals. You know, high ideals, and Buddhism makes big promises. You know, Buddhism makes some big promises. You know, the Buddha said, to be alive is to experience suffering, but there's an end. There's a conclusion to suffering. And that's like, wow, you know, I mean, I knew about the suffering part, you know, but I didn't know that there was a way to get out of suffering. And so, you know, that's like the ultimate promise, you know, actually, I can liberate you from suffering, or you can live, the Buddha actually never said that, he said, you can liberate yourself from suffering, and I can show you how to do it. So, you know, that's a huge claim, people who get interested in Buddhism, I think, and in Zen in particular, have some experience of suffering, and they would like to be released from it, you know. And Buddhism makes some big claims, and it can create some obstacles, actually, some misunderstandings that have to be worked out in the course of one's practice. When I was just getting started in Zen, I think it would be fair to say that I had some experience of suffering. I think I was probably suffering at the time in lots of different ways. I wasn't physically suffering, but I had a lot of psychological suffering, you know. I remember going to sit at the Zen Center and running into Genki Roshi. I remember how powerful he was as a kind of archetype of enlightenment. He was like a guru figure for me. I first met Genki Roshi at a Wednesday night sit, I think, at the university. Maybe not, you know. Now that I think back on it, I had sat with the Zen group at the university a couple times, and then I actually went to a sesshin, and I got to the sesshin, and there was this little Japanese guy mopping the floor. And I didn't think he was the teacher. I thought he was like, you know, I didn't know who he was. But he was mopping the floor, and then somebody said, that's the Roshi, you know. And I had already read some books on Zen, you know. So, you know, to me, that was just such a powerful moment because, you know, I mean, it just resonated very deeply that this person would be deeply enlightened like the Dalai Lama, but he'd be mopping a floor like an ordinary person. And it was just like, oh my God, that's him, you know? And then, and he's mopping the floor. Amazing, you know? I really put Genki Roshi on a pedestal. And by the way, it was easy to do because Genki Roshi was really a deeply awakened person, you know? He was, you know, I mean, Genki Roshi would come in and sit down and he wouldn't move for hours. I mean, not even like a muscle. And then he'd just like get up, like it was like literally he was a puppet and somebody pulled the strings and he just jumped up. You know, it didn't seem to be making any effort. It would be like he was sitting there and then he'd just suddenly be on his feet. And he's like, wow, that is so cool, you know. And he was extremely compassionate person. He was so kind. You know, my first sesshin was just murder. You know, I had only done a little sitting. And I went, and for those of you who have been practicing, have heard this story so many times, you want to blow out your brains. But those of you who have never heard the story might find it charming, you know. You know, I had just started practicing with the Seattle Zen Center. And I went to a Wednesday night sit, and it was announced that we were going to have a sesshin. And they said, would anybody like to sign up for the sesshin? And the leader of the Seattle Zen Center at that time was a beautiful Japanese-American woman named Wendy Nakao, who is now the abbot of the Los Angeles Zen Center. But after the sit, she came up to me and she looked me right in the face and she was so beautiful and she said, would you like to come to sesshin? And I thought, yes, I will. What is sesshin? Anyway. Little did I know, right? It was like, yes, and that was Genki Roshi's first sesshin in the United States. And I met him. He was mopping the floor. And by the way, he was not used to working with American students. And so we had 45-minute sits all day long. And that was, oh my God, it changed. By day two, it had to change, right? It was like, you know, people were not used to, it was like 45-minute sits all day. It was, oh my God, it was really unbelievable. And I remember going into Dokusan, you know, and just like literally crawling into the Dokusan room. My legs they hurt so much. I was in so much pain. And I sat in front of the Roshi, and he must have been so obvious. He said, I know you're in a lot of pain. It's like, oh, you know, thank God, you know. And, you know, so he was so kind to me, you know. I mean, for some reason, I expected him to treat me unkindly, which says a lot about me, you know. My father was very harsh disciplinarian and a very unsparing person in a lot of ways. And so I guess when I went in front of Genki Roshi, I thought he was going to, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, buck up, you know, blah, blah, blah. And instead, he was so kind and compassionate, you know. And then he did other things at that first sesshin. You know, we rented a place on Hood Canal, which is this beautiful, it's not a canal at all, it's a channel, it's a natural fjord in Washington State. And it was right on the water. The place where we had sesshin was a little bit like Murray Grove, except that their kitchen was right off the zendo, and there was no door on the kitchen. So Wendy would actually prepare the meals in advance, and then she'd quietly heat up all the food while we were meditating. And I can just remember being in agonizing pain and hearing her in the kitchen. Anyway, late at night, you know, we'd all be doing zazen in the zendo at night, and we would hear rats coming into the kitchen, and they'd be squeaking, you know. And I was sort of delirious, actually. And I remember hearing those rats and thinking, what, you know, what next, you know? But the next day, Genki Roshi said, you know, where I'm from in Japan, rats are considered a good omen. He said, you know, if a rat has been living in a certain place for a long time, you know it's a healthy and safe environment. And he said, so, you know, naturally, we're not going to hurt the rats in any way. We just want to make sure that all the food is covered up so they can't get in. You know, all the rice and things like that are secured. But they're a good omen. So when he said that, I just thought, this is my teacher. You know, this guy is my teacher. You know? And if somebody had told me he could fly, I would have believed it, you know. And I really idealized him so much, and he very rarely let me down. You know, he was such a good human being. And I was really, like, ashamed of myself sometimes in his presence. And I wasn't really sure why I felt ashamed. But I remember one day I was walking down University Avenue, and I didn't have time to think about it. I saw Genki Roshi coming up from the other side, you know, coming up in the other direction, and my heart started pounding. I was like terrified that he would see me. And maybe I was thinking about girls or something. You know, I don't know. I was probably walking down the street, you know, having sexual fantasies in my head. And I saw him, and I was just terrified. And I actually jumped into a store, right? You know, like a record store or something, till he passed. And I was like, oh, thank God he didn't see me and see what I'm really like, you know. Whenever I was around Genki Roshi, I was always straining. You know, I was thinking, I'll try to be my very best self, my very best Kurt, you know. I think there's an element of this in the aspiration to be awake, you know. You know, when we see somebody like the Dalai Lama is, you know, such an amazing person, you know. I mean, he really is like almost all love, you know. It's just amazing how, and he seems to have so few barriers, you know. He seems to be so unwilling to maintain any barriers, you know, any protective barriers. I remember seeing this photo of the Dalai Lama with some cardinal from the Catholic Church, and the Dalai Lama just leaned over and grabbed this man's hand like a schoolboy holding a schoolgirl's hand. And he looked so sour and uncomfortable, you know. And the Dalai Lama was just beaming, you know. And I don't think he was trying to embarrass the guy. I think it was just the difference in the ways they are they're being in the world, you know, that one guy is striving so hard to be perfect, and the other person has done something else. You know, what is it that he's done? You know, I mean, the Dalai Lama seems so relaxed and so natural, and this other guy is like trying to be Cardinal so-and-so. I just thought their body language was, they were worlds apart. One was very rigid, and one was very relaxed. And I think, however, that there are people in the Buddhist world too who are like that cardinal. They're very rigid, very, you know, it's like they're constantly monitoring themselves for signs of what they fear, you know. I don't know if this is making any sense, but, you know, the desire to be awake is a healthy desire. The desire to be enlightened is a healthy desire. And in Buddhism, we're taught that all people will achieve enlightenment sooner or later, no matter how long it takes. In Buddhism, there's a hell, but nobody goes to hell forever. They just go to hell for a little while. And then they're reborn, and then they eventually achieve enlightenment. So the whole universe in the Buddhist view is like a giant machine for producing enlightenment. But the point is, you know, basically, I think becoming like the Dalai Lama, becoming a fully awake person, means that we have to, in a certain way, realize that we can't just be good, or we can't just be perfect, you know? We have to recognize that in ourselves, there's the whole spread. There's the whole enchilada, you know? And you know, this desire to be like perfect, to be a bodhisattva, to be fearless, to be spontaneous, is all for the good, you know. But actually, it can become an obstacle when we aren't aware of the complexity of the universe or the complexity of the mind itself, you know. I'm going to say something that's going to be pretty shocking. But I think the Dalai Lama might have sexual fantasies. You know? Yes, it's possible. I think the Dalai Lama might get mad once in a while. You know? And it's possible to say, well, then he's a hypocrite. He's a phony. He's not fully awake. But I think that would be a mistaken view of what it means to be, to have a mind, you know. So here's where I'm going with this, you know. When we're practicing Zen, we can enter into these states of a awakened mind, which are quite advanced and are quite wonderful. So, for example, when I'm in deep samadhi, And I'm really in Mushin, I feel absolutely fearless. And I feel like there are no problems in the world. None. Right? And I am in that state quite often. Quite often. I certainly am in that state at Sesshin a lot of the time. And Sesshin is over, and I get in my car and I drive home, and then I look in my email and I have an email from somebody, maybe it's from some dean at Rutgers, and I begin to feel afraid, you know, like afraid. And, you know, being afraid is maybe a strange word to apply to a letter from a dean, you know, but when I was a little kid, my father was very harsh disciplinarian, and I was very afraid of him, and he wanted us to be really afraid of him, and he was very successful, you know. So we learned to be afraid. So that's sort of like the baggage, one of the pieces of the baggage that I carry with me, you know. I'll look at this email, and I'll think, ooh, I'm fine. You know, I won't actually, I might not think it, you know, actually. You might just see it and think, well, I'm not afraid, you know. But you are afraid, you know. And if you're honest about how you're feeling, you say, oh my gosh, you know, I'm actually afraid of opening this email. Now you could say, well, there, all my fine practice is just down the toilet, you know. But I think that's not quite accurate. I think that's a false view of what it means to be a human being. You might have seen these wonderful Tibetan tankas, tanka, T-H-A-N-K-A. They're paintings, and they show like a panorama, and it looks like a scene from Tibet, in pre-modern Tibet. Really, they're maps of the mind. They're a map of the mind. What's really, really represented is the mind itself. And, you know, in the tanka, there would be, at the top of the tanka, is like the sun, which is basically the source, consciousness. You know, when people talk about Daikensho, this is what they're talking about. So there's the sun. And there might be a sun and a moon, which are two different aspects of enlightened mind. And then there's the mountain peaks, and they're pure and clean, right? And there's clouds blowing by. So the sun, and then the mount, then the clouds between the formless Dharmakaya and the world of form. And then there's the mountains. And in their initial, as things take form, they're totally pure and lofty, right? And so you get the mountains, and then they'll be like the guru, and there'll be a guy sitting on a cushion with a sash over one shoulder, and he's in lotus posture, okay? And then you go down farther, and there's like a dzong, there's like a fortress or something, and then there's like a village, and then, you know, and you look at the village, and there's things going on. You know, somebody's doing laundry. You know, you look in the window and people are having sex, you know. Or maybe somebody's delivering a baby, right? And then there's an alleyway and somebody just shot somebody else through the eye with an arrow, right? And then at the bottom there's a wheel and there's the Lord of Death holding this wheel, you know, at the bottom. And it's like, so, you know, we've gone from enlightened mind into the world of form, and then we've gone down into all the complexities of the human mind, right? There's fear, there's love, creativity, there's friendship, there's, you know, adventure, there's beauty, there's fear, anger, lust, jealousy, you know, aggression, you know, and so on and so on. So it's like the whole thing, you know. And then there's this, at the bottom, there's the burning wheel in the hands of the Lord of Death, you know. Now, you know, one way of thinking about the path is that we're moving from the bottom to the top, you know, so we want to get rid of these bad qualities and become good. We want to, you know, and that's certainly an element of the path, you know. But beware, because you know what? The whole thing is you. The whole thing is you. See, this is the mind. You can't have the enlightened part without this other stuff, see, you can't. You know, the tanka is telling you something, right? This is the whole. All of this is in you. All of this is in mind. All of this is. These are all aspects of mind. Mind is like this big hotel, and you start at the ground floor, and you know, basically, there's sinister figures lurking in the lobby, and people are selling smut and whatever, you know, and somebody's getting robbed, and you get up, you go up the stairs, and you meet people who are reading Shakespeare, and then you go up here, and, you know, and so on and so on. Finally, you get up to the top, and the door opens, and there's some guy sitting there in an empty room, doing meditation, and then you go up to the top floor and you open the windows and there's the blazing sun shining in your face. And this is all you. All of this is you. All of this is you. And, you know, in America, we are really dedicated to this idea that we can eliminate all bad things from the universe, you know, that we can create a perfect society, and that our job is to eradicate all things that could be bad and just have the good. This is like very American attitude. You know, when the Puritans came to the United States, they said, we're going to create a pure society with no sin, no lust, no bad thoughts. And they created a society that was like a hell on earth, you know, of repression. And so they created a society also that didn't last very long, right? But this goal of ours, you know, I remember talking to Janet Walker. Janet Walker said something, you know, she said in, her teacher, her guru in India said, you know, really, there's always been about the same amount of good and evil in the world. It's not really going to change. You know? And I think the Buddhist view would be a little different. They would just say, look, all of this is part of you. All of this is, it, you know, Adolf Hitler is in there, and, you know, St. Francis is in there, and Milarepa is in there, and, you know, Henry Miller is in there. It's all you. It's all you. I think becoming a fully realized person is complicated because, you know, we have to integrate, we have to recognize all of these different elements and find a proper place for them, you know. So you know, when I can be in a state of mind which is fearless, absolutely fearless, and then I can also experience fear. And I think it's very important to admit to myself that I experience fear sometimes, and to say, well, what are the causes of my fear? And to try to explore and investigate those causes, you know? I may be able to deal with my fear more intelligently and more skillfully, but I can't do that if I won't admit that I have fear. You know what I mean? I hope this is making some sense. You know, you'll meet people sometimes in life who are very angry people, and they might be totally oblivious to this, you know, because they formed an image of themselves as not an angry person. I have known people in the Buddhist world who actually are quite short-tempered, you know. They can be very, very angry. And yet, when they think about themselves, they see themselves as very compassionate. But if you, very briefly had an experience with a man named Hirano Katsufumi Osho. And he was like, on the outside, he seemed so sweet and gentle and compassionate. But if you did something wrong, he would become explosively angry at you. You know, like it's terrifying, right? And so he'd be very nice. He'd be very, very, very friendly and nice. And but if you did, you know, here's something that actually happened to me. I had just come to a couple of sesshins, and I was having trouble with my legs. You know, by this time I was trying to sit full lotus. But when I would sit full lotus in pants, my leg would slip down off of the fabric, you know. So I would pull one leg up, and then I'd pull the other leg. But the leg wouldn't stay up. It would start sliding down. And especially if I had pants on, it would slide down. So I would start the sit, and I would be in the right posture. But by the end, my foot would slide right off my leg and go down onto the ground. So I didn't know what to do about this, and I asked a friend, and he said, well, why don't you wear robes? And when I sat at home, I sat in my underwear, you know. So when I sit without, you know, in my underwear, my skin, my ankle hook, you know, somehow is held on the thigh. Naturally, the skin to skin doesn't slip. Who knows why? You know, it's some really interesting aspect of the human body, but well designed for meditation. So anyway, a friend of mine gave me a set of robes, soto robes, and I remember putting them on and wearing them to a sesshin, and I didn't put them on properly. And this was a sesshin where Hirano Osho-san was guest leading. He was the guest leader of the, and he took one look at me and he exploded in rage. And he took the keisaku, the teaching stick, and he pounded me. You know, he was like hysterically angry. And you know, this is a trait of somebody who hasn't come to terms with some aspect of himself, right? His own anger, his own fear of making mistakes, See, he was so terrified of making mistakes that when he saw somebody else making a mistake, he wanted to annihilate me, really. And it was like, you will never make this mistake again, young man. You will never put your collar like that. And he literally, it was like he, now why was he fighting me? So why was he hitting me so damn hard? You could say, well, somebody hit him, yes. But I think he was terrified of something. Something had happened to him in his life. He was terrified of making mistakes, see. And he never confronted that, you know. He'd never confronted that. Years later, I learned that he had been in charge of teaching students at Eheiji, and he was eventually removed from that job. And he drifted around the world, actually. He became like a freelance Zen teacher, but he had some problems that he hadn't worked out. And I think it was because, you know, you have your eyes on the top, you know, the luminous, radiant, compassionate self that we all want to be, but we have to be willing to encounter those aspects of ourselves that aren't perfect, you know. And you know, I think when Hirano Osho-san sat on the cushion and he was in deep samadhi, the compassion probably poured out of him like water, you know. But on the other hand, when he was off the cushion, there was something he hadn't worked through. He wasn't aware of this aspect of himself. And I think the more advanced forms of practice, a lot of the koans, for example, are designed to help us see things in ourselves that are frightening precisely because they are imperfect, if this makes any sense. So, you know, how to deal with our imperfections, that's a complicated issue. You have to be willing to, first of all, see them, or you have to be capable of seeing them. So, you know, you can think, I'm a fearless person. I sit down on the cushion and I'm fearless. And, you know, and you get back and you might not allow yourself to say, oh my gosh, I'm actually frightened of this dean, you know. But, you know, seeing it, sometimes it can only happen by accident. Sometimes a koan can help us to understand what we're not willing to see. But once we've seen it, see, this is really positive, because now we understand this is part of who I am. Part of who I am is able to sit fearlessly on the cushion. And part of who I am has a problem with people in authority, you know. It makes me scared, you know. And so you get, you know, I was talking the other day about knowing your fox. This is another version of knowing your fox, right? You know, I think somebody like the Dalai Lama knows his foxes. The Dalai Lama knows he's got certain things inside of him that he has to work on. He has to be aware of. Maybe it's anger. You know, his country was invaded. 1 million people were killed. You know, the government in Beijing is a lying, manipulating, conniving government that will stop at nothing to maintain power. Could the Dalai Lama be a little mad? I think so, you know. I'm making a little sense that, you know, when you look at that tanka and you see the sun, the beautiful mountains, the yogin in the valley meditating, the village, people doing the laundry, making love, robbing somebody, et cetera, you know, all of this, you could say, well, that's the world, but that's yourself. All of that's in there. You know, it's all in there. You know, there's, you know, the difference between like the Dalai Lama and that cardinal was the difference between somebody who's acknowledged the whole tanka as part of himself versus somebody who's working very hard not to embrace certain aspects of himself. You know, recently, you know, there was a scandal involving a Zen teacher in New York who was sleeping with his students, and I think this is a classic case of somebody who hasn't come to terms with the whole tanka in himself. You know. And these kinds of scandals happen all the time, especially among religious figures who are, you know, supposed to be very, quote, pure and so on and so on. But they don't allow themselves to acknowledge their own humanness, right? The goal of Zen practice is not to become superhuman. You know, I have heard people describe the Buddha as like a superman. It's like, oh, no. That would be a fictional character in a comic book. You know, actually, Superman has a cape and flies through the air. The Buddha is a fully developed human being. You know, and so, you know, basically, the Buddha, you know, when the Buddha left his home, they say he didn't know about sickness, old age, and death. And then when he discovered them, he left his house. But that's surely not true, right? I mean, he would have had to be mentally impaired, right? Not to know about sickness and old. I mean, he would have never read a book, you know, and so on and so on. So you know, that story is just a fairy tale. The Buddha knew about those things when he encountered them on a particular. In a particular context, they set his mind, made his mind uneasy, or actually set it on fire, and so it triggered a psychological event that sent him out onto the road. You know, but the Buddha had a normal life of a male in his age. He had wife. You know, the Buddha had sexual desires. The Buddha saw his own people annihilated. The Shakya people were basically genocided in his lifetime. So, you know, basically, this is all part of the psychological world he had to deal with. And all of this stuff can be in the service of enlightened mind. Even fear can be in the service of enlightened mind. So if you turn the tanka upside down, that's like the wrong way to live, right? The tanka can be turned upside down, and that's like the world as it shouldn't be lived, right? But the tanka can be right side up, and there's a harmony to this. This is like life in balance. You know, I've talked about this before, but if you go to a Chinese temple or a Japanese temple, outside the temple you'll see these incredibly fierce warrior figures, right? And they're giant. They're actually like nature spirits, and they usually have like their hair is fire, you know, or you know, and their eyes are popping out of their head. They look like if they just look at you, they'd kill you, you know. And they're terrifying. Joseph Campbell, one of his books, he has some pictures of these. And he said during World War II, when he was growing up, in American propaganda, they showed pictures like this in the paper, and they said, the Japanese worship gods like this. You know? Isn't that interesting? But Campbell, you know, correctly said, actually, the message of these is that why are these horribly fierce figures guarding the temple? You know, because what it's saying is we admit that aggression is part of the whole tanka, right? That aggression is part of it. So the question is, how can this be integrated into an enlightened life, right? So you have to acknowledge, the existence of aggression, but it could be destructive aggression or it could be constructive energy, and so it has to be transformed. If these figures being outside of the temple in a Chinese or Japanese temple would be the equivalent of going to a cathedral, and instead of having angels around the gate, they'd be devils, see? And all the devils would be smiling and beckoning you to go into the church, see? And that would be like a mind blower in the West, right? Because they're supposed to be sent to hell and banished from the universe. But the Buddhist view would be, even devils can have a change of heart and become positive energies in the universe. So basically, it's a fundamentally different view of things, right? When we repress or when we deny these elements in ourselves, jealousy, envy, fear, we aren't getting closer to enlightenment. We're creating a split in ourselves that's quite far from the unified mind in accord with the way. See, I just love, I think somebody like Joshu, was just so natural. What is Joshu? North Gate, South Gate, East Gate, West Gate. What is Joshu? That's somebody who the North Gate is, basically one way to deal with the koan like that is, the North Gate is Buddha, light, compassion. The South Gate is anger, greed, et cetera, et cetera. Joshu says, they're all in me, And I found a way to integrate all these forces in with compassion at the top. It takes a lot of courage to do Zen practice because it's not just about eschewing evil and embracing good, right? It's also about understanding what are the sources, what are these energies, what are these desires and impulses, these energies in me, and how can they be transformed in a positive way? I hope that makes some sense. Deshan's the completion of study, see, is all the, when are you done your Zen practice, what is the completion of study? And the completion of study is the integration of the whole enchilada, see, it's the whole tanka. And it means that you have to, part of Zen practice, it's not just like you're screwed up and then you do Zen practice and then you have enlightenment and now you're not screwed up anymore and all your screwed up elements have been banished to hell, right? That's not it. It's like you are practicing and you're encountering things in yourself. Some of them are beautiful and astonishing. And, there's like, you are like a fountain of compassion. Sometimes people in meditation just, love is flowing out of them. Well, that's there. And sometimes you want to kill, Me, I don't want to kill, but you sit on the cushion and all of a sudden you go, oh my God, I do want to kill, Yeah. Or you say, I'm not afraid of anything. Well, there's a few things I'm afraid of. Yeah. I love this line from Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde was a 19th century playwright and a man about town. And he was gay. And he was eventually went to prison for it. But he was a brilliant man. And he's just really a great writer. One of the things he said, at one point he said, Your Honor, I can resist anything but temptation. Did I already say that? I don't know. Yes, okay. Well, thank you. I love that line, right? Now, I actually think he was, he had a pretty mature understanding. He knew he understood his foxes, he wasn't embarrassed, he wasn't ashamed of himself. And he made a very creative life.
He became a very creative person, and I think was quite compassionate, actually. Very, I think he had a successful life. So, there's even, you know, this is really quite an interesting path, don't you think? This beautiful path of Zen. We have to, it's not about being a perfect person. That's like prigs, you know. We're not about being prigs, you know. This is about being the full development of the human being, the full embrace of all things in the universe. This is the unified mind in accord with the way. Deshan's completion of study takes in the whole tanka, from top to bottom, from heaven to hell. It becomes one beautiful life, one beautiful world. We have to confront these things in ourselves that are difficult to admit. You know? Great Master Yun Guan Ming of Deshan said to the assembly, "When you get to the ultimate end, you find the Buddhas of all times have their mouths hung on the wall. There is still someone who laughed. Ha ha." See, I mean, when we find something in ourselves that we don't like, first we might want to cover it up. And then we might think, oh my God, you know, this is so humiliating. This is so terrible. You know, I can't believe it. Or we deny it, you know. At some point, you know, when you find a way to integrate all this stuff, this idea of laughter, of, you know, really, there's a kind of, you know, real joy. I think that when you have, let's say you're just one more thing. You know. Sometimes we've had experiences, you know, in our lives where people have done things to us. Like, we're growing up, and mother clearly favors the other brother. You know, she goes, "Oh, I love all my kids equally. And here's this for you. Here's the candy for you. And, oh, you get an apple," you know. And it's like, "No, but I wanted the candy." Well, I love you equally. See, I gave him the candy, and I gave you the apple. It's equal, right? You know. So you grow up, and you get these signals, you know, so you might become a jealous person. Right? Or maybe your parents actually make you compete with your siblings for affection, you know. And then you do meditation for 10 years, and you think, I'm pretty much a clear empty mirror, you know. And then you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, you know, maybe at some point you come face to face with the fact that you're jealous of people, and you're jealous of something. You didn't make yourself jealous. Something in your life made you that way. You know, there's no sense beating yourself up. And at first you might be deeply ashamed, and you might really be very self-critical. But at some point you realize, I'm jealous sometime, and now I see it for what it is. You know, and then it's kind of like the absurdity of it, right? You know, at some point, you can, you know, this old saying, you can laugh at yourself. You can laugh. I mean, you know, we try to laugh at ourselves sometimes, but it's so hard. But sometimes you can really laugh at yourself, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, I can be jealous, or I can be an idiot sometime. I can be, you know. That's really great. To have that kind of perspective, that kind of maturity, is really a hard achievement, but it's really wonderful. So, you know, there is still someone who laughs. Ha ha. If you know this, you really, you know, he says, if you're at this state where you've seen your foxes, you know, you've seen them, you know them, you've seen them 1,000 times, you're not ashamed to have a few foxes, you know, we all have our foxes. You kind of laugh, you can laugh it off because you understand. You can forgive yourself, in other words. I forgive myself for not being perfect. I'm not perfect, I forgive myself. See, it's like, you know, usually life is a lot better. And he said, if you're like that, you're done. You know, you've done it all. It's really great. Gathering in, holding close to throat, wind polishes, clouds wipe. The waters are chill. The weather is autumn. Don't say brocade-colored fish lack rich taste. Fishing through the ocean waves, one hook of moon.